Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with Catherine Page Harden, professor of psychology at the University of Texas, about the ideas in her first book, The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality, which attempts to reconcile the findings of her field of behavior genetics with her commitments to social justice. And you can learn more at KPHarden, this is all one word, KPHarden.com. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, TerrenceMcNally.net. I hope anyone who listens to this show on a regular basis believes that I mean it when I say it's about a world that just might work. Rather than be identified as political or progressive or environmental, though at times it certainly may seem to fit all of those, I want these conversations to be a search for a world and a society that works. Works for as many as possible, not just for city dwellers, not just for college graduates, not just for Americans, not just for those living now, but also for generations to follow, and even not just for humans, but for the rest of nature as well. And if you were to ask me what values animate my sense of things working, as much as anything, I'd say it's about fairness and justice. If each of us and our institutions play fair, we have our best chance of creating, sustaining, and living in a world that just might work. Listeners to this show also know that we talk a lot about inequality and about minority rule, which is another form of inequality, inequality of representation and power. And I found it interesting that today's guest begins her book, The Genetic Lottery, a book about the science of behavior genetics, which investigates the influence of genes on character traits and life outcomes. She opens this book talking about inequality and fairness. But then I recalled some advice that Catherine Page Harden gives about crafting policy to improve society. She says we should begin by asking these three questions in this order. What are our values? What is the science around the issue or the intervention we're considering? And then how do we promote our desired values, taking into account that science? So, before she wades into the science of genetics, she lays out her values. And for her, like me, fairness is right at the top. Her primary question in the book and in her work seems to me to be, how do we integrate what we learn about the influence of genes into our efforts to build a fairer society? Though most people now readily accept that genes influence our height, our weight, our eyesight, cardiac health, many seem to get nervous when we apply that same perspective to things like our psychology, our mental health, intelligence, our educational attainment. Like so much else these days, there exists a cultural or political divide around this. On the left are those inclined to insist that genes don't really matter. On the right are those who suspect that genes are, in fact, all that matters. Confronting this controversy, Harden writes, quote, "The genetic differences between any two people are tiny when compared to the long stretches of DNA coiled in every human cell. But these differences loom large when trying to understand why, for example, one child has autism and another doesn't, one is deaf and another hearing, and why one child will struggle with school and another will not." She says genetic differences between us matter for our lives. They cause differences in things we care about. Building a commitment to egalitarianism on our genetic uniformity, on the basis of believing that we're all the same genetically, she says, that is like building a house on sand. I enter this conversation with both ambition and humility. Ambition, in that I think these questions are important in moving our society and individuals within it toward greater equality of opportunity and expanding our potential for satisfaction, fulfillment, meaning in our lives. Humility, in that I'm not well versed in this science, especially its subtleties and its nuances. I often describe what I do in these conversations as teaching while learning, or learning while teaching, and I hope that today's conversation bears that out. Catherine Page Harden is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas, where she directs the Developmental Behavior Genetics Lab and co-directs the Texas Twin Project. Dr. Harden uses behavioral genetic research methods to understand the developmental roots of social inequality. In particular, her lab's work seeks to answer two questions. What biological and social processes lead genetic differences between people to cause diverging life course outcomes? And how do social contexts, families, schools, neighborhoods, interact with genetic differences to shape individual development? The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality, is her first book. Welcome, Catherine Page Harden, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for that very generous summary of what my book is about. I can tell that you've read it and you've thought about it, and I really appreciate how well you've laid the foundation for our conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, February 15th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you do today? And feel free to go way back, mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing. The story, the narrative of Page Harden and her work.
Okay, well, that's quite a task. I think one obvious starting point is college, where I started off college thinking I was going to go to medical school. I think this wasn't really because of any clear passion or direction. It just sort of seemed that that's what kids who are good at science go do after school. But I got invited the summer after my freshman year of college to work in a lab on campus. I went to Furman University, which is a small liberal arts school in South Carolina. And because it's a liberal arts college, there's less research happening, but if you are involved in research, there's a lot more direct interaction with your professor than, say, at a place like Texas, where my undergraduates work mostly with my graduate students or my postdocs. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of intermediaries. So I was working with a professor there at Furman, Judith Grizel, and she was doing research on genetic mechanisms for opioid withdrawal and tolerance, mm-hmm. which is actually a really important issue. It was a kind of a research topic ahead of its time.
Yeah. Remind people when this was.
So I was a freshman in college in 1999.
Wow.
So this was the summer of, I guess this would have been the summer of 2000, which mm-hmm. is a different world in a lot of ways. So this is before the opioid epidemic. And, but it's a very common problem when you're using opioid drugs that people become very tolerant of their effects, and that's why people who, for instance, are using them in end-of-life care need really massive amounts, and they stop being effective. So she was studying, using genetic tools, which parts of the opioid receptors were responsible for different parts of the drug's effects. So it was a very biological approach. It was very experimental. With mice, you can actually inject things in their brain that turn off certain parts of their genomes, things that you can't do with humans. And then we were studying, well, how does this affect their substance use? The ease with which they become addicted to morphine, the intensity of their withdrawal from morphine. So very early in college, I had this exposure to the idea of behavior genetics, that genes made a difference for organisms, in this case mice, behaviors, in this case substance use behaviors. And then after that summer, I subsequently did a summer internship at Northwestern University looking at genetic differences between rats, so still in the rodent world, in relation to a model behavior for antidepressant response. So what we were looking at there was how did, which parts of the genome differed in between rats who, say, responded to rat Prozac or gave up more easily when you put them into a pool of water from which they could not easily escape. When I was at Northwestern, I had the opportunity to interact with both MD students and PhD students, and I realized, oh, I actually am much more interested in the research track. These are the people that I want to be like. My whole life, it's really been important for me to have models, to think about, okay, in 5 years and 10 years, I want my career, or I want my trajectory to look like this person's. And the grad student that I worked with at Northwestern just seemed to have the sort of intellectual life that I really wanted. And so I changed track. I was no longer going to go to medical school. I was going to apply to a PhD program. And then towards the end of college, I happened to take a clinical psych class as just part of my major. And it made me realize, oh, I would much rather study this in people than in rodents. I actually am really sick of rodents. I don't want to clean out animal cages anymore. I don't want to be responsible for there being other people cleaning out animal cages anymore. So I ended up applying to PhD programs in clinical psychology, and I ended up going to the University of Virginia, where my mentor there had just gotten a grant to study genetic influences on child development. And so we were kind of the perfect fit. I was coming with this genetics background, but more from an animal experimental approach. And he was interested in using genetics to study child development. And I wanted to not work with animals anymore. And so that's how I ended up in the field of clinical psychology, but still with this focus on biological influences on human behavior, or on behavior generally.
Let me jump in for 1 second, because we've gotten up now to graduate school, but I'm going to share a little bit of my personal experience. I was, although I guess I'd seen it originally, when I got back to preparing for this, I was a bit surprised to learn that you were in the field of psychology. And I assumed your work on genetic inequality was in what I might consider a harder scientific field. You know, my work where I've dealt with genetics and stuff before was in hard science. So first of all, I think I have some preconceived misunderstandings of psychology and so on, but I'll, right? Of hard.
Yeah, but psychologists are cringing right now.
I know.
Psychology is a hard science.
That's
yeah.
right. But let me tell you before you answer on what my misunderstandings might have been, and then go back to your path, that here's a bit of my personal history. When I attended Harvard in the late 60s, I majored in social relations, which was a combination of social psychology, social anthropology, and sociology. And it was headquartered in the 17-story William James Building. And I recall there was a clear divide between what I thought then as harder or experimental psychology and softer or clinical psychology. And what echoes your experience is there were floors that when the elevator stopped, I knew were full of rats and pigeons. And those are the floors I never got off on.
Yes, I mean, I think you're right that there's, so, you know, there's this division within the sciences generally. There's this great XKCD comic where it's about, you know, the purity of different sciences and the idea that, you know, the biologists kind of envy the chemists because they're looking at more basic process, and the chemists envy the physicists.
Right.
And the physicists envy the mathematicians. And, you know, whenever you try to understand a phenomenon, you're necessarily going to raise questions about more basic processes, which is going to push you into wondering about the field that's focused on a lower level of analysis than you're focused on. I think psychology is really uniquely positioned in that spectrum of hard sciences to soft sciences, because psychology's psychology is the study of mind and behavior, right? That's what I tell my students in intro psych. I teach intro psych.
That's right. You teach, by the way, let me just say that one of the things we're talking, you know, in this sort of narrower realm of genetic behaviors and so on, but what you also teach the kind of intro to psych.
Yes, yes. And, you know, when we pitch it, when we think about that, what is the scope of psychology, which is to study the mind and the brain and behavior? That is in and of itself spanning that whole spectrum of hard to soft. Mm-hmm. The brain is something that my colleagues study with what we think of as the classic tools of hard sciences, right? They're experimenting with animals, looking at this part of their brain responds to this drug. They're breeding animals that have specific genetic profiles. You know, they really want to understand the biology of the neuron. And at the same time, we're thinking about the creation of the self, the creation of an identity over the course of a human life, which is necessarily happening within culture,
yep,
within social relationships. So I think it's really impossible to be a psychologist for very long without having to borrow tools and perspectives and questions from all of the hard sciences and all of the soft sciences.
Right, right. In other words, you're going to reach
animals.
You're going to reach to biology for something, but you're going to reach to social anthropology for something else.
Exactly, exactly. You can't understand humans without asking questions about nature, and you can't understand humans without asking questions about culture. It's always both and, not either or.
Very good. So now you're in grad school.
Yes.
So and now you found you're attracted to clinical psychology, but you have this strong background in biology.
Yes. So in clinical psychology, you know, a lot of people think of that as a strange combination, behavior genetics or genetics and clinical psychology, where you're also learning to be a therapist, because obviously therapists aren't CRISPRing anyone's genes, right? Like we're not in there doing little viral vectors in the therapy room. I was trained actually by supervisors who are very dynamically Freudian oriented, mm-hmm, which is different on paper from the hard sciences, mm-hmm, maybe as you can get. But there's a big push within clinical psychology towards, well, how do we root our interventions in science? Mm. How do we, if we're gonna try to help people, then we really need to have a good science of human behavior and a good science of what causes what in the human social field. And in particular, when you're doing therapy with children and adolescents, so often you're not intervening just with the child, you're also intervening with the whole family system. You know, one of the most effective treatments for child conduct problems, for instance, is parent training. The kid isn't even necessarily in the room the whole time. You're focusing on what are the parents doing, what is their approach to discipline, what's the chaos in the family system. So if you are an empirically minded person and scientifically minded person, and you're trying to think what are the things that I need to intervene in a child's school or a child's family in order to maximize their chance of success and flourishing and happiness and well-being, it turns out that that's actually a really difficult scientific problem, because children aren't just getting their environments from their parents, they're also getting their genes from their parents. So the science of behavioral genetics, which is how do we measure, how do we take into account genetic differences between children, turns out to be very related to this problem in clinical psychology, which is how do we design interventions to help children succeed in life, by identifying what aspects of their social contexts are the most high kind of high value target for intervention. And so, mm-hmm, that's how those two things go together.
Mm-hmm.
I will say also, you know, an American clinical psychology PhD is very weird. It doesn't exist like this in other countries, because you're trying to do two things. You're trying to develop research expertise as a scientist, and then you're also learning how to be a therapist. that's in some ways, you know, two pulls on your time that can be very much in tension with one another. On the other hand, I think it's always good to remember that I'm not describing with my data the lives of rats, but the lives of people. A colleague of mine who's a sociologist often uses the phrases, you have to remember there's flesh on the numbers. Mm-hmm. And I think clinical psychology is uniquely positioned because it puts people in the room with patients who are experiencing psychopathology or with families who are experiencing some sort of trauma or disruption or dysfunction, that these are not just numbers in mm-hmm. a spreadsheet. These are people's lives that you're theorizing and hypothesizing about.
Oh, quick question, Paige. How is it different in other countries?
So in other countries, you often get a clinical psych PhD separate from a research degree in psychology. Mm, okay. So people might train to be therapists the way they might train to be social workers. There are exceptions to this, but usually they're much more divided. The American psychology clinical psych PhD, where you have a clinical training program embedded in the same department that does behavioral neuroscience of rat brains, and expects there to be crosstalk between those departments, is pretty uniquely American.
Okay, thank you. So, what are you studying, and how does it shape what you're doing today?
So, from graduate school, so I will say in graduate school, I had a pretty successful but typical academic track. So I published a lot of journal articles that, like all journal articles do in the sciences, address relatively narrow questions. So for instance, children in families where there's lots of marital conflict show worse behavior problems. Is that because the marital conflict is modeling something about them for their behavior? Or because parents who fight a lot have certain genes that they then pass on to their kids, and it's a genetic link between the parents and child. So I had a, I would say, a pretty typical research career through grad school and then my early assistant professor days here. And over the years, I would say there was this growing realization that the way that I thought about the kind of larger meaning that you can take from genetics, the way that I saw that was very different from the way that this research was commonly discussed or debated or interpreted in larger conversations. And so I kind of dipped my toe a little bit in writing more for the public about genetics, and that kind of spiraled, and then I found myself writing a book. I will say that, you know, there are people who write books knowing that they're going to get attention, or people that write about things sort of deliberately courting controversy. Mm-hmm. And that is not me. I'm not a person that loves being the center of attention or the center of controversy. That's not really my personality. So it's a little bit ironic that I ended up writing a book that did cause so much controversy. Because in my view, I thought, well, I'm an academic. I know a lot about this topic. I want to write about how I see it. I'm going to do it for this, you know, for Princeton, this academic press. You know, maybe 25 people will ever read it, but I can get it down on paper, get it out of my head, and then I don't have to think about it anymore. And that's obviously not what happened.
It caused
a much bigger conversation than that.
Right. Let me say one thing, which is that I interview people who do, you know, really academic stuff, but usually by the time I find them and have them join me, they've shifted at least somewhat to writing for the public. And mm-hmm. as you know, there's a big difference, and it's interesting.
There
this is your first book, but it's interesting when you see people like Deborah Tannen, for instance, whose first few books were very academic, and then she writes People Just Don't Understand That It's a New York Times bestseller for a year. It's interesting when people go through that transition. And when I saw this book, I was almost surprised that it, I mean, not really, but because I knew I'd ordered it from them, that it was Princeton University Press. One thing is that it is written, I think, for a popular audience. You are attempting to make things understandable to a popular audience. And one other thing is that it's only 258 pages plus notes. It's not, no, you know what I'm saying.
It's not, I didn't want it to be an impenetrable tome.
We have enough of those.
We do.
Yeah. So I will just say that, but you know, I understand what you're doing too. And I think part of it, I want to do one while we're on your path.
Mm-hmm.
You just spoke about how you were surprised that this turned out to be so controversial and so on. But in the New Yorker profile from September 2021, which I may have referred to in the introduction, I'm not sure. But you talk about how the work you're doing is controversial. The profile is a lot about that, and you talk about an experience you had at the Russell Sage Foundation, when you had a fellowship there. Can you talk just a bit about that? Because I think it sets up in a human way sort of what we're talking about in terms of why and how this is controversial.
Yeah. So just to back up a second, the Russell Sage Foundation is a really interesting private foundation that funds research on social inequality, broadly defined. Russell Sage himself was a railroad magnate who acquired a very large income and then died. And then his young widow proceeded to then give much of the money away. One of the things that she did was found the Russell Sage Foundation. So their kind of hallmark program is this residential sabbatical where they bring together scholars from across the United States to live in New York, where the Sage Foundation headquarters are located. And you're given a lot of space and time to work on a project related to social inequality. But it's all of the offices are in the same building and you have lunch together every day. So it's a small group of people from disparate intellectual backgrounds who are encouraged actively to be in community with one another, with the idea that that's going to foment some interdisciplinary collaboration, some productive tension, some new directions with research.
But by its nature of both the foundation and this program, there's something which holds them all together, which is this thoughts about social inequality and so on. But then it's all the different disciplines and all the different approaches, which is where the ferment is to take place.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And the kind of historical emphasis of Sage has been on sociology, economics. Psychologists are less well represented, and people who do things in a biological lens, so this could be neuroscience, this could be genetics, this could be epigenetics, are even less represented.
Sure.
So I was a little bit of an intellectual outlier in the group. And, you know, it's not like you give a talk and if people don't like it or if people have questions about it, they might ask one or two questions and then the group disbands and you don't see each other ever again. These are people that you have lunch with every single day and you have conversations with around the way that you see things. So while I was there, there was a lot of research that was coming out, a lot of which I talk about in the book, that's identifying specific DNA variants, specific DNA differences between people in relation to educational outcomes, how far people go in school.
Mm-hmm.
And this was garnering a lot of attention. The first paper of this sort was published in Science. There were subsequent ones in Nature and Nature Genetics and in Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. So prestige glam journals, garnering big headlines. And that wasn't the work I was doing at the time. My work was more focused on using twin and adoption studies versus looking at measured genes. But it was my field. And so it just became a topic of conversation over the course of the year that really turned impassioned, you know, and it, I think the passion comes from a place of some people feeling that there is no way to link genetics to social outcomes that isn't necessarily going to lead to bad social policy, or that isn't necessarily eugenic in its intention, which is not the way that I see it.
Right.
Like, again, I'm coming from a psychology background. Of course, biology is related to behavior. We studied the brain and the mind. But there is a view, and I think this is a really strong view, particularly in some of the social sciences, some anthropologists and some sociologists, that it doesn't matter what the values of the scientist are, that the work itself, just the act of linking biology to behavior, is inherently either instrumentally bad or kind of categorically bad, like in a normative bad sense, like not just dangerous but immoral. And okay. And so there's this real kind of values conflict that genetics brings up that became less you know, it's easy to ignore the tensions that exist between disciplines when you don't have to talk to people outside of your discipline every day.
Yeah.
Right? Like when you're not next to them in the buffet line for the pasta. So that it really kind of rubbed it up. And then when I went to write the book, again, I thought, well, this might spark some controversy within the academy. And I want to write about, I want to make my case for why I don't think this work is inherently or instrumentally, necessarily instrumentally bad or dangerous. But I think the extent to which these debates that are happening within the academy are also of interest in the wider world, as people are kind of struggling with, like, well, what does equality mean? What is fairness in our really diverse society? I think I underestimated the extent to which the conversation would echo outside of the ivory tower.
Okay, let me tell people what we're doing here, and then my next question sort of is, well, those people who think that looking at genetics or looking at biology when we're looking at educational attainment or poverty or those sorts of things, what is their justification for saying that's bad? We'll get to that in a second. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Catherine Page Harden. And we're talking today about the ideas in her first book, The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality, which attempts to reconcile the findings of her field of behavior genetics with her commitments to social justice. And you can learn more at her website, which is kpharden, kpharden.com. So what is the foundation that from which springs this conclusion that the work you're doing might be bad or dangerous?
Well, the idea behind this, or I guess this fear, is very much rooted in the history of how genetics has been used in the past. So if we look in the United States, we can see that the earliest biostatisticians, so the people who were kind of inventing the statistical methods for the study of heredity, were already at that time saying, well, if genes are related to your likelihood of ending up in poverty, or if genes are related to your likelihood of doing well in school, then that justifies really atrocious limitations on people's reproductive rights and liberty.
Mm.
And so what we see is the Virginia's Sterilization Act of 1924, which legalized, or 1924, I think it was actually earlier than that, early 1920s. So it's legalizing the forced sterilization of women, particularly poor women who are categorized as quote unquote feeble-minded. The constitutionality of that law is what was tested in the infamous Buck v. Bell Supreme Court case. Which has said that, yes, actually involuntary sterilization is constitutional. what's very interesting to me actually to read that now is they cited as their precedent the mandatory quarantine measures for the Spanish flu epidemic. They said if you had the ability to forcibly quarantine someone, you had the constitutional right to forcibly sterilize someone.
Wow.
And then Nazi Germany used Virginia's laws as its model for their own sterilization. So with that history, of course people are worried about the dangerousness of that. I mean, they would be wrong not to, like, it would be silly and naive not to be. And my case is never that there's nothing to worry about. You know, we don't need to worry about history repeating itself, like that safely passed. I definitely don't think that's the case.
Right. And let me just jump in one second, Paige, and say that obviously what we have seen happen politically and culturally over the last few years in terms of white supremacy coming out of the shadows and so on, just makes it very clear what you're saying, there is history, and that history is still alive.
That history is still, I mean, when we're thinking about the Unite the Right rally in, that gathering of white supremacists, that happened in Charlottesville.
Like, and you were there studying at the time.
That's where I was a graduate student. But Charlottesville is where Carrie Buck from Buck v. Bell is buried.
Oh,
right?
My.
She was hospitalized and sterilized just up the road in Stanton, Virginia. So that history is very alive now. I think what we're seeing currently is very interesting because we once again are living in a moment in which there is very powerful political forces that aim to limit reproductive freedom. In this case, it's not involuntary sterilization, but it's laws against abortion, potential threats to contraception. And if you look at anti-abortion activists, the people that they are most likely to cite are not the geneticists saying, look, genes matter. They're actually more likely to cite the opponents of geneticists saying, look, we need to be afraid of this polygenic score stuff, and we'll come back to what polygenic scores mean.
Yes.
We need to be afraid of this polygenic score stuff, and so therefore we should not have IVF and not have embryo selection and not have abortion. So we're having this realignment of the conversation around genetics and reproductive freedom compared to what we saw in the early 20th century. So history, it doesn't exactly repeat itself. It there's a rhythm, but it's not identical.
Yeah.
There's new dangers arising. But I think, given that danger, which we all agree is there, how do we move forward? What do we do from here, knowing what we know about the past? And I think that's where I differ from a lot of my colleagues, in which I think deliberate ignorance doesn't save us.
It seems like it's another history. Right. Another way of looking at the deliberate ignorance. It might not even be actual ignorance, but it's just we don't talk about that.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think there's it's really been interesting to talk about the book both to my colleagues within the academy and then to people who are not academics. Because within the academy, I often hear from other professors, isn't it dangerous to tell people that genes influence children's lives? And then I talk to people outside of the academy, and they already know that. That's not news to them, right? You know, if we survey Americans, they think that genes make a difference for their children's success in school and personality and risk for depression and risk-taking behavior. Anyone who's had, I mean, I talk about this in the book, but really anyone who's had more than one child already knows that children come into the world not as blank slates. They're bringing something to the table from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think many people within the academy have a poor theory of mind about what people outside of the academy already think and already know about the power of genetics for people's lives. And so they think that maybe we can hide that knowledge or like keep it under wraps or something. And I'm like, well, but you know, people observe other people. Like they know some things just based on being a person in the world. With
well, besides, as I pointed out at the top, you can't say it influences height and weight and whether you are liable to have high cholesterol and say it doesn't influence these other things. It's like, it's so funny that, I mean, not funny, it's ironic that academics who know more about this would make such a sort of obvious error the man or woman on the street wouldn't make.
Yeah. Well, but I think this is not just academics. This is the, all of us are in our silos. All of us are in our conversational habitats and niches. And, one thing that I really love about teaching intro psych, I actually think it's one of the most valuable things for me as a writer and as a speaker, is it constantly surprises me what an 18-year-old thinks is novel or interesting or something they already know and what they want to talk about and what their questions are. It is this constant, well, I think this is such a cool study, or I think this is such a cool topic, or I think this is going to blow their minds. And they're like, yeah, whatever. And this other thing that I think is so obvious, it's not even worth saying, my email inbox lights up. So I think that that constantly having to be in conversation, you probably have this too as a podcaster, constantly having to be in conversation with people who are brand new to the topic is really good for developing a theory of mind about what people already know and don't know.
Sure.
Who haven't been thinking about this this one little topic for 20 years the way that I have.
Right, right. I want to pivot from that Russell. So what you were saying was that at this Russell Sage Foundation in that year, you found that other folks there responded to you and your work more harshly than you had anticipated. And you have written that this experience was a pivot point for me, away from a career that was almost entirely about the production of empirical research and toward doing more meta science. Okay?
Yeah.
My question is going to be, what does meta science mean and how does it relate to having impact in the world? But I wanted to share with you something else from my experience, which I think you will relate to. In my podcast for the Wyss Institute at Harvard, I interviewed David Walt. And David Walt is both a very successful entrepreneur and a very successful scientist, okay? And he distinguishes between outputs and outcomes in measuring one's impact in the world, including academia. Outputs in academia are things like publications, citations, doctoral students, etc. Outcomes are results in the real world. And my guess is that when you're shifting to what you call meta science, it has to do with that sort of a shift.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I really like that distinction between outputs and outcomes. I think that's a really useful way to kind of gain some distance from the metrics that, you know, are easily counted by a university administration. So really thinking about what value do I want my work to bring to the world? I love that distinction. So meta science, I think, is related but not exactly the same. Meta science, I just think it, you know, kind of like the science about the science or the conversation around the science. So some people do meta science where it's, you know, how does changing research practices change outputs and outcomes? And some people do meta science, which is, you know, the philosophy of science or the sociology of medicine or the how do we do scholarship about what questions are being asked in the science, how those results are being disseminated, and what meaning they have in the larger world. After Russell Sage, I really thought the problem was I wasn't doing a good enough job making my case, like explaining what I had in mind. And so I thought, well, if I have a book-length treatment of this, then I can really spend the time, describing what I mean you know, that'll clear things up.
Yeah,
that'll clear up the confusion.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, if I set myself that task, the measure will be, have I done a good job of laying all this out? And then the question is, and what does that good job, what's the response I get?
What does that look like? So I will say that my favorite, you know, just thinking about, well, what outputs do I value in the world? And one thing that I have most valued about the response of the book is when people write me and they say, you know, I've always been very different than my siblings or my parents, or my path through life has been different through theirs in some way. So children who raised in poverty who are now kind of flew through school mm-hmm. and experienced a lot of upward mobility, people who struggled with addiction and no one in their family really got it, right? Like they were the only ones who really had that problem. People who adopted children and then realized, oh, I'm dealing, you know, I'm playing a deck of cards, but like this deck of cards is different than what, you know, other people in my family have. Mm-hmm. Like I'm getting to know my child. People who've worried about having children and what, you know, if I struggle with something, will my children necessarily struggle with that? So people like that who've written to me and said that something about my book has helped them see their own family situation more clearly or think about their family situation differently in a way that gives them sort of peace or a new perspective on it. And that is the one of the best outcomes for this particular output is, how does the science help you make meaning of your own life?
Yes.
How have you been able to think about your own life differently in some way? And then I would say the second category is people who write to me and they say, gosh, you've muddied the waters for me. You know, I thought I knew. I thought I knew what I thought about fairness, or I thought I knew about what I thought about affirmative action, or I thought I knew this about equality of opportunity or meritocracy. And oh gosh, like now I'm not quite sure what to think. Oh, I love that. Like,
yeah, no, it's interesting. So the ones you like are the ones that say, wow, you clarified something. And the other ones who say, wow, you declarified. I like
that. It's like the old pastors that say, like, you know, the purpose of the church. I was raised in the church. The purpose of the church is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comforted. And I'm like, the purpose of science is to clarify confusion, but also complicate, oversimplified conclusions.
Right. Well, another way I put that is its purpose is to answer questions and to question answers.
Yes. Yes. I think that's a great way to say it.
Okay. So let's lay out for people. We've got at this point, 10 more minutes. I think they've got the gist, but we've talked about the controversy. We talked about the context and so on. What's the point of this book, Paige?
Yeah, so the first point of the book is something that you've already described, which is that genetic differences between us matter, and they matter for things that are psychological. So our personalities, our temperaments, our risk for mental health problems, and our likelihood of doing well in formal schooling. The second point of the book is to describe how one of those outcomes that we know is influenced by genetics is a real divider of haves and have-nots in American society. So if we look at the difference between people who have completed a college degree versus people who haven't in the U.S., the gap between them in terms of income, but also longevity, physical health, life satisfaction, well-being, is wide and getting wider over time. So we have this genetic lottery, this thing that happens every time a child is conceived, which is, out of all the possible combinations of genes that a child could get, which ones did they get? That outcome of the genetic lottery makes a difference for our psychology. And then our society is set up such that people who do well in school get more of nearly everything that we care about in society, and of basic goods and things we want, like health and security and political power. So in the book, I talk about, how do we make sense of of that in terms of theories of equality. A really influential thinker for my book is the political theorist John Rawls, who never really talks about genes. He was writing in the 1970s. But he does use this metaphor of the natural lottery. And he has this famous thought experiment mm-hmm. of what would be if you were blind to your outcome in the natural lottery and the social lottery. So if you had no idea which genes you were going to get or which parents you were going to get, what rules would you set up for society? And he says that that's a way of thinking about fairness is, you know, you figure out the rules of the game before you get your starting position in the game.
Right. So you don't know whether you're going to be born rich or poor, rural or urban, black or white, male or female.
Learning disabled are not learning disabled. Right. ADHD are not ADHD. Vulnerable to alcoholism, not vulnerable to alcoholism. Extroverted or introverted. You don't know any of that.
How would you design society? What
would
the rules
you design
be?
Society? And I think from that perspective, that throws into relief, I think, a fundamental unfairness of American society right now, in which we spend a lot of time debating the stakes of meritocratic competitions around higher education. Like, how much has been written about, like, who deserves to go to Harvard? Or, you know, what rules are we doing for who gets to get into MIT? And not nearly enough on what do we owe people by virtue of them being people in a fair society, regardless of their genotype, regardless of whether or not they happen to inherit genes that make them really great at the sorts of things that we stress in formal education. So I want to take that thought experiment that Rawls, you know, wrote about so compellingly and remind ourselves of its importance, given what we now know scientifically about what an outsized role this genetic lottery is playing in shaping people's life course outcomes.
Okay. And you see that genetics provides a tool, information about someone's genetics provides a tool, and that if we actually want interventions to be successful in creating a fair and just society and giving people greater equality of opportunity, that we have to use that we can't pretend it doesn't exist, because then we're not using everything at our disposal.
Yeah. I mean, if we think about, this is something that I ask people to imagine. I want you to imagine that in every school district, in every classroom, in every school of education in America, the information that we had about a child's family income disappeared. It was deleted. Like an alien came in and every variable and every data set that said whether this child came from a poor family or a rich family, gone. Now, it doesn't get rid of the poverty. It doesn't get rid of the effects of the poverty. It just gets rid of our ability to see which child is coming from an impoverished background versus a wealthy one. How much harder would it be to figure out what's working in education? Are we serving people who are most likely to fall behind? Are we leveling disparities, eliminating disparities in education, if we deprived ourselves of the ability to see differences in the backgrounds in which children are coming from? That is the situation that we find ourselves in right now with regards to genetics. We know that genetics is just as strong a predictor of educational success as knowledge of children's family income is. And yet we're trying to figure out what works in education, what works in therapy, while we're kind of flying blind without regards to that piece of information that we have about kids' backgrounds. And at the same time, we are... we're depriving ourselves, I think for those of us who care about social justice issues, we're depriving ourselves of, I think, a really valuable piece of rhetoric against people who really want to justify the current status quo as fair. And that is pointing out the kind of moral arbitrariness of what genes you happen to inherit And how is it fair if that plays such an outsized role in people's, you know, getting the basic goods that we care about?
Okay, let me just say what some of the uneasiness people have, or at least the delicacy of what you're talking mm-hmm. about. Your yeah. mentor, Eric Turkheimer, who mm-hmm. you have both a mentor and a colleague, he says you have to believe in a certain amount of genetic causation or you don't have a science. And you can't believe in too much genetic causation, or you believe that poor people are poor because they have poor genes, and that's a very, very delicate walk. So he's talking about your work. You are doing a very delicate walk. And what I see is, following your approach, does that mean that we have to genetically evaluate people and use that information, which means revealing that information ahead of time to those who might be involved in mitigating genetic risk? The teachers, the guidance counselors, the psychologists, and so on. And aren't we worried about what people might do with that information
yeah.
due to either yeah. ignorance, misunderstanding, or intentional misuse? How do we protect against that? I found myself thinking that this is like nuclear secrets or you know, contagious viruses, that not many can be trusted with that information or that substance. Am I exaggerating? Am I alarmist? How do you qualify people? How do you police access and distribution? And this will basically be the last question.
So I don't think it's alarmist to worry about the misuses of private information about genetics, right? So do you want, for instance, your auto insurer to be able to assess your insurability on the basis of your genotype?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want your life insurer to be able to set your rate based on that?
Your potential employer.
They're your potential employer. Those are real conversations that we need to have. And I, you know, the fact that you bring up, you know, viruses, you know, that is a framework that a lot of people have talked about genetics. This kind of is this dual use or research of heightened concern in mm-hmm. which, on the one hand, we don't want to say, there can be no virology labs. You can't do any of the experiments that you do to better understand viruses, because then we wouldn't have things like mRNA vaccines
right.
that were developed, you know? Like, we need that knowledge. On the other hand, people don't just put virus, you know, genetic codes on the internet for just like anyone to have, right? So there's both protections of against misuse, but then also how does the legitimate scientific application of this proceed? And that's exactly the tightrope that we're trying to walk in the realm of genetics. So I don't think it's, you know, Miss Susie, the third grade teacher, gets a rundown of all of her students' genomes at
right,
the beginning of the third grade class.
And we also, just to throw in, then we also have the danger of Pygmalion in the classroom, right? Which is that
yes.
if you tell people something, that's what they'll see for the rest of that academic year, whether the kid's behavior fits it or not.
But if there's a researcher who's randomizing students to, you know, curriculum as usual, new fancy curriculum, and finding that on average new fancy curriculum is improving math scores, and then they're testing, well, is it improving math scores for everyone? Mm. Is it improving math scores for the poor children? Is it the rich get richer, which is a really common thing in educational
yeah.
interventions? Is it working for people who are most genetically at risk for poor math outcomes, for math learning disabilities? Or is it, you know, only working for people who are already kind of advantaged with regards to their measured genetic risk for educational outcomes? So that's, you know, a researcher dealing with private information with all of the burdens of privacy and confidentiality and data storage, not just like passing it out to the guidance counselor, you know, in the teacher's lounge. Those are very different uses of it. At the same time, you can think about the amount of private information that's already brought to bear for some children in an educational context. If you've ever had a child with a, you know, a learning disability or who needs sort of special services, they have, you know, an IEP, an individualized educational plan, and family history is brought up to that, right? So this child has a family history of autistic spectrum disorder. They're not yet meeting diagnostic criteria, but might they qualify for additional services within school to give them you know, a free and appropriate public education. And I think it's interesting to think about, could genetic information be used as an additional source of information that children and their families can use to advocate for services for them, the way that we currently use family history?
Okay. I think we've got to wrap it up. So what, if I can, and you say, if you tell me if you agree with me, what you're saying is it's not ready for the school down the block tomorrow, but we've got to start the conversation. We will not come up with rules of the road if we don't get out on the, if we don't think we're going to travel on that road. And that what you're saying is, it seems like there's potential value. Let's start the conversations so that we can figure out how to take advantage of that.
100%. We have to have the conversation now, and we have to think about not just what do we not want to do with this incredible power, but what can we do? What do we want to do in a way that's consistent with our values? I think both sides of that conversation are absolutely necessary.
Very good. Okay. Thank you. So, the book is The Genetic Lottery, Why DNA Matters for Social Equality, and you can learn more at kpharden, K-P-H-A-R-D-E-N, one word, kpharden.com. Thank you, Catherine Page Harden, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to about 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at macmac.com. And you can find years of podcasts at my site, or most of those podcast sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.